All right. Welcome, everybody. We're already at chapter 9 of our functional programming course. And today, I'm really excited. Today, we're going to talk about the I/O monad, the mother of all monads, or as it's sometimes called, the sin bin of Haskell. So far, we have talked about Haskell programs that can be used to write batch programs. So really, we wrote just functions that take inputs and produce outputs. But we didn't speak about programs that could interact with their environment. And so in some sense, we've only showed like toy examples, calculating the length of a list, changing a string to uppercase, but not very exciting programs. And a lot of people might have the question, how can we hook up Haskell programs or functional programs in general, pure functional programs, to the real world? And in the real world, programs interact with their environment. In particular, they read values from the keyboard and the mouse and all kind of other devices, and then they print output on the screen and maybe on a printer. They write to a file, things like that. So the picture of if you look at the input and outputs of a real interactive program, it takes the normal inputs and produces the normal outputs, just like a pure function would do, but it also interacts and side effects with its environment. And the question is, how can we achieve that in a pure functional language? And to rephrase what a pure function is, a pure function in Haskell is exactly like a mathematical function, a mathematical function that you learned about in high school. If I have a function from A to B, that means if A1 equals A2, then f of A1 equals f of A2. If I'm passing the same values, I'll get the same answers. What this equation doesn't really show is the notion of time, but really another way of looking at this is saying, if I'm calling that function with the same argument twice, I expect to get the same results. Now let's look at a function, say readLine. readLine. And suppose we would give that type unit arrow string. Well, it's obvious that if I do readLine twice, that's not the same, right? The values that I get back are probably not the same. Yes, they're the same if I type in the same string, but in general, that will not be the case. So readLine is not a mathematical function. Now you can ask yourself, how on earth can we write a function like readLine in Haskell if it's not a mathematical function? So the trick we use is to use monads. And we have seen monads when we talked about parsers. And the thing is that you put in its type, you say, this is a function that has a side effect that will do I/O, that will communicate with its environment. It's a really simple trick, and it will give us the ability for Haskell programs to deal with their environment. So when we write an interactive program, you will see that its type has type I/O of something. And the type I/O type is the type of actions that return a value of type A. Or stated differently, a value of type I/O of A is a computation that might have effects on its environment and then at some point will produce a value of type A. An analogy that I often use is with a watch. If you look at a watch, you can look at a time and it gives you a time, but a watch is not something of type time. It's something that every time I look at it gives me a different time. So a watch in this case would have the following type. My wristwatch has type I/O of date time. My watch is a computation that every time when I ask for a new value will produce for me a different value. It's very much like a read line. I can read the time of my watch. And it's, in fact, it's very similar also to write line, because I can set the time on my watch by kind of pulling that little thing. So let's call that read wristwatch, and I can write to my wristwatch. What would be the type of that? Well, I take a daytime, and I return nothing, because I'm just changing it, but the type shows that I'm doing a side effect on my watch, that the time is now changed. Here are a couple of other examples. I/O of char, that's a process, a computation that returns a character as an effect of running that computation. And here we see the I/O of unit, that's very often used. That's a computation that returns nothing. In C# and Java, that would be void. So if you have a method that returns void in Haskell, that becomes I/O of unit. And in a previous lecture, I have explained that if you write a function, a normal function, if I say I write function f that takes int to unit, as a mathematical function, that is not a very interesting thing, because the only thing it can do, f of x equals, well, it can only return unit. So it, this is basically the only way I could define a function of that returns unit directly. But when I do I/O here, suddenly I can do arbitrary side effecting things in here. So that makes functions of type I/O unit very useful and powerful, as opposed to functions of type unit, of return type unit, that really cannot do anything. The Haskell standard library contains a number of imperative or side effecting functions, and one of them is getchar. Getchar is a function that returns a character, and while you read the character from the keyboard, it echoes it on the screen. And even though I say here getchar is a function, you know, the type is I/O of char. Another way to write that, if you really want to make it in a function, you would say getchar has type unit arrow I/O of char. But since we're lazy, it doesn't really matter to make this a function or not. It can just be a value of type I/O char. I think this one is a little bit more useful or familiar to imperative programmers, because there the type would be getchar and take no parameters, so it looks more familiar. But the reason is that if you look at in an imperative language, if I define a variable of type character, it's hard to get different values each time if I don't assign to that variable. If I make it into a property, then you know you don't call it with the parentheses, and then it would be very much like just having I/O of char. All right, so the opposite of reading a character is putting a character on the screen, so that's putchar, and its type is, given a character, it will return an I/O of unit. So it will produce a side effect, but no return value. As we've seen with parsers, you want to be able to inject a simple value into the monad. And in this case, for the I/O monad, that function is called return. It takes a value of type A, and it returns a result of type I/O of A, and that immediately returns the value without producing really any effects, but the type still says that it is an effect, which allows you then to compose normal values inside side affecting computations or inside I/O computations. Let's look how we can compose a couple of these functions. this example we have seen with parsers as well. What this one does, it reads a character from the input, calls it x. It reads another character that it doesn't give a name. Then it reads a third character, it calls it y, and then it returns the pair xy. So what this function does, it reads three characters from the keyboard and then returns the first and the third. And this one uses the do notation. Let's refresh our memory about the do notation. So you can write do, then I can write x taken from, this is something of type t, and then here I can have some expression of type io of t. That's why there's an arrow and not an equal sign. So I draw the value of type t from that computation. So in this case, I call getChar, which has type io of char. I pull it out of the computation and I call it c. Then I can leave out that one. So in this case, let's use the example getChar. And this is character. Stay concrete. So getChar was something of type IO of character. I pull it out, I get a character. Then I call getChar, which reads a character from the keyboard but doesn't give it a name. It's an abbreviation for underscore or some other name drawn from, but we can leave that out. And then we read the third character, getChar, and then we return x, y, and remember that this has type char, char. It's a pair of characters, and since return takes a value of type A to a value of type IO of A, the result of that guy is now IO of a pair of characters. And hence the result, and I like to put my semicolons here, and now the whole result of this expression is also IO of pair of characters. Again, this should be really familiar with you now, is whenever you see an expression, you look at its types in order to understand what this expression does. And when you have the types, then you can understand or figure out what expression has that type. So the types kind of drive the expressions. And if you have an expression, by inspecting the type, you can learn a lot about what that expression does. And this do notation is syntactic sugar for bind. Another way of writing this thing, the bind, as this in Haskell looks like this, called bind, which takes something of type IO of A, a function from A to IO of B, and returns something of type IO of B. People in C-sharp or in Visual Basic will recognize this signature of select many, and that is no coincidence. Link is just another variation of monads, and this do notation that you see here looks in C-sharp and VB like queries, where we write from x in getChar, from y in getChar, select x, y. So there's a very, very deep correspondence between link expressions on the one hand and monad comprehensions on the other. And that becomes clear when you look at how these monad comprehensions are translated. They're translated in terms of this bind guy here, which is select many in C-sharp. Let me try to write that guy using bind. This is what the Haskell compiler will do. It will say getChar, which is a function of type IO of A. I'm calling that x, so let's say lambda x. I'm going to put here IO of B. Lambda x arrow. Now I say getChar. That's the second one. I bind that. I don't give that a name. And now I say get jar again, the third one. I bind that one to y, and then I say return x comma y. If I unsugar that do expression, it will look like this. And now you can see why we like to write these monad comprehensions, because this looks doesn't look pretty. There's all these bind operators, there's all these lambdas, and the do notation is much more concise. And just to remind you, how would this look in C sharp? Imagine that we would have a version of getJar and some IO type, and where getJar would have type unit arrow IO of jar. Then in C sharp, you would write that query as or that expression as follows: from x in getJar, from, so C sharp doesn't allow you to kind of leave off the name, so I'll just use underscore as my identifier, getJar. Then I read the third character from y in getJar. And then instead of saying return, I say select new x comma y. And then this thing will have type IO of some anonymous type that I cannot write down. In Visual Studio 2010, we have tuple types, so you could do this as a tuple. But I prefer to use anonymous types. It's a little bit unfortunate that since they are anonymous, I cannot write down the type. But this will have type IO of something of type X of type char and Y of type char. Some fantasy notation for anonymous types. To make a long story short, whenever you see these monad comprehensions, think of query comprehensions in C sharp or VB, or even better, whenever you see query comprehensions in Link, think of monads. And just like we have seen the parser monad and the IO monad, in Link, you can have multiple implementations of the sequence operators, so you can use the same notation, not over IEnumerable, but you can define your own type. And it comes with two types, IEnumerable and IQueryable, out of the box, but you can define your own implementation of the sequence operators by defining select many and select and a number of these operators that are then used by the C-sharp or VB compiler to take this expression and translate that into the underlying monadic operators. Exactly the same as what Haskell does. Let's look at yet another example. I'm going to wipe this out. The next example shows how to read a string from the input. And we read a string from the input by reading subsequent characters from the input. And this is a little recursive function. Like in Haskell, we always usually use recursion. So what we do is we say, read a character. If that character was a new line, then the string that I have read is empty. So I return the empty list. Otherwise, I recursively read the line. I call that result x's. Again, look at the type. GetLine has type IO of character. So when I say x is from getLine, x is has type string. And then I return the string where I cons x, the character that I just read, to the rest of the string that I recursively read. This is a nice recursive formulation. So you're kind of going into the recursion, and then as the recursion unfolds, you stack the characters that you read in the front. This uses also the fact that in Haskell, a string is just a list of characters. Let's see now how we can write a string to the output. That would be a function of type string to IO of unit. And since the input is a string, the first thing that comes to mind is to do this by recursive case analysis over the input list. What do we do with the empty list? Well, in the empty list, we have no choice than just returning unit, which means do nothing and return unit. That has type IO of unit as required. Then when we have a list, a non-empty list, well, what can we do? Well, we just print the first character and then recursively write the rest of the string. If you remember the previous lecture where we talked about faults, this function you can define as a fault on a string. Let's try to do that. So let's look at putString. Goes from string to IO of unit. And remember that when I do a fault of plus E on the list, I replace the old R. If I replace cons with plus and the empty list with E. In this case, I replace the empty list with return unit. So that's easy. So I would say here, return unit. And now what is plus doing? Well, plus x plus the result of the recursive call. Well, let's call that, you know, I don't know, doesn't really matter. And let's call that P, because I do need it. So what do we need to do? Well, we need to kind of, you know, say, I want to take x, I need to print it. So we do put char of x bind p. And that is the recursive call. I think I need to be a little bit careful because now I think I need to do this p. I don't have a type checker here. But I think there might be a little bit of an error here. But you see, the general idea is that I don't have to use this recursion. I can write this as a fault. And if we want to write a string to the output and put an empty a new line at the end, we just call putString, and then once that's done, we put a new line at the end. Okay, let's look at a slightly more complicated program that uses now getLine and putString and so on to do a little trivial interactive program. So usually a program like this has type IO of unit. It doesn't return any useful value, but it does side effects. And so I do putString of enter string. The effect of that will be that I print on the console, enter a string. Then I read a line from the input. And then I print out the string has, and in here, this show length x's is a normal pure expression that I can use inside the side effect in computation. And then I say whatever characters. And again, this is a really, really trivial example, but that's not the point. What this example tries to show is that you're using side effecting computations, IO computations, and inside there you're calling out to a normal pure function, that show length of x's. And I often call Haskell the world's best scripting language, because the IO monad allows you to kind of script, glue together these IO computations and normal pure functions in a very powerful way. And that's kind of what you see happening here. I'll come back to that a little bit more when we're going to talk a little bit more about how we can define our own control structures. That's one of the things that when I say it's like a scripting language, I can define my own control structures on side effect and computation. I don't have to assume that anything is built in. So, but I'll talk about that at the end of this lecture. If I run this example, and I type in, you know, string length, that thing has type IO of unit. So this, I type this in hux. Then hux will run that program and say, enter a string. I type in the string, and then it will echo to me that the string has 5 characters. And this is something magical is going on, because if you look at something of type IO of unit, really that still is a pure value. And only when you execute that, the effects happen. And sometimes I say that's like Haskell is cheating, because inside Haskell, I'm still all doing pure functions. But then when I execute something of type IO of unit, the side effects happen. But there's no way from inside your program to kind of observe these side effects. So you really separate the construction of your program, the building this type, this value of type IO of unit, and running it to produce the side effects. Let's look at another example, a very trivial example again, but it shows how you compose these IO actions. It's a version of Hangman. So what you do is you type in a secret word, and then you try to guess the word. And once you have guessed the word, you know, within a certain number of guesses, you win. In this case, we don't keep a count. We just, you know, you guess the word, and then we tell you which letters you've guessed correct. So that's why I say this is a very simple version of Hangman. The top level looks very much like we've seen before. We print something on the screen, think of a word. We get the line from the input. Then we print something again, try to guess it. And then we're calling this function guessWord. GuessWord, what should its type be? Let's look here. Well, since this thing has type IO of unit, we know that guess of word must be of type string arrow IO of unit. How do I know that? Well, because word comes from getLine. So that means that word has type string, because getLine had type IO of string. That's here. So what does getLine do? It reads the characters and echoes, instead of echoing the character, it puts a dash. It's like a password input. It doesn't show what you type, because the other person has to guess the word. For this, it uses another function, getCH, which is a version of getChar that doesn't echo the character on the screen. And there you see this way of doing hux. In hux, you can get call out to primitive functions or C functions using this primitive attribute. There's, if you're interested in general on how to call C functions from Haskell, there's an appendix to the Haskell language definition. It's called the Haskell FFI, the foreign function interface. And that's a very nice document to read. It's a very powerful way to import Haskell functions from, say, C land, and to export Haskell functions to native code. People have done all kind of interesting things with that. Years and years ago, we used this to make Haskell talk with COM. And people use this still today to hook Haskell up to all kind of interesting libraries that are often written in C. So if you want to use Haskell in the real world, you definitely should learn the foreign function interface, which tells you how to import things into Haskell, import native functions into Haskell, and to export Haskell functions into native code. And whenever you import a native function, a unmanaged function into Haskell, usually its type becomes IO of char, because these things are written in C, so they will have side effects. Okay, let's continue with our example. As I predicted, guess would have type string arrow IO of unit. And how does it work? Well, we're typing a prompt to indicate the user to type in a character, a line. We read the line, and then we check to see if the word that the user has typed is the same as the word that we're looking for. That is the word we passed in into guess. And if that's the case, we say you found it. And what we otherwise do is we print the differences of the word that the user typed with the word that, you know, our secret word, and then we just recurse in a till recursive way. If you remember when Don Syme did his guest lecture on F-sharp and he talked about agents or mailbox processors, that worked very similar, where you had this still recursive loop where you kept the state, in this case word, as the argument, and this thing would call itself at the end. That's exactly the pattern that you see here. Guess word does some stuff and then calls itself with, in this case, the same state. If you would modify this program to keep track of how many guesses there were made, you would put an extra parameter. So instead of taking type string to IO of unit, this thing would take, say, int to string to IO of unit, where int would be the number of guesses. And there would be a conditional: if the number of guesses, you know, is zero, the remaining guesses, then you've lost. And otherwise, it would recurse with itself with like guesses minus one. So that's the trick where you state that you pass to yourself in a till recursive way. Now, that diff function is a pure function. So this is the pattern that you see where you go outside of the monad now, outside of the IO monad, and just do a normal computation. So in this case, diff uses our good friend list comprehensions. It takes two strings, and what it does is it replaces each character that is not the same by a dash. So if that x is in the string, it will echo it, otherwise it will put a dash. So here's an example. If I take the diff between Haskell and Pascal, then since the A appears in Pascal, I will echo it. Since the S appears in Pascal, I will echo it. And since the L appears in Pascal, I will echo it as well. And here you see, again, I have this IO side effecting computations, and in there I'm doing some pure computations. So the exercise is to write a simple game of NIM, where I won't go into this. You can read it yourself. What I would like to do instead is use the last couple of minutes to explain why I said that Haskell, that I consider Haskell to be the world's best scripting language. Let's, for example, look at this program here, this guess. You see what it does is it prints something to the screen, reads a line, then does something again, and then recurses. Okay? Now, that's a pattern that we saw all over again. So let's write it down here. Guess word. What does it do? It says do, print something, put string with a cursor. Then it says give me read. I need to kind of make sure that I copy the example correctly. Read something from the reader, from the user, get line. Then it does something where, you know, in one case it terminates, and in the other case it recurses with this thing. So what I now, if I abstract from that, I do if some p of x's, in that case I do, let's say I'm terminating. So let's call that terminate. And let's call that access. And else, what I did, something like put string line, what's called that terminate is like, you know, success of access. And then I'm nearly kind of at my boundary here. Then it's recursed to guess with word recursively here. Okay, so you see that I've already abstracted a little bit from what's going on here. And so now I want to also abstract from what's going on here. So let's kind of, you know, say this is a message. I get that guy. I already used here some predicate. Then I terminate and I pass that X's. And I do something when there's a success. And I guess with the word. Now, as I said, when I want to change that the state, I would call here some function next with state. Let's see that I abstract over everything now. Let's also abstract from this guy here. Instead of doing a put string, we say here prelude. So this can be any action. So do something, read the input, then based on the outcome of that, terminate or do something and recurse. Now, let's look at this guy. Now I can say, well, it's really abstracted over this guy, over that guy, over that guy, over that guy, and over next. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 parameters. So the way you could write this now is I'm just defining a new function, and let's call this P. So I pass P. Oh, that's let's call it PR. I'm running out of space. That's why I'm abbreviating. This takes P. Let's call this terminate. Let's call that T. And I pass that X's. So I need to take here T. Then I do success, let's call that S. And then I need to have next, let's call that N. So I pass all these parameters here, and then of course I have to pass my state, which was word, let's call this W. And then here, instead of calling here recursively, I call this guy recursively with PR, P, T, S, N, and N, W. So now I've kind of removed everything that's specific for this particular problem. I've defined now a general higher order function for doing interactive dialogue with the user. And now I can reuse this. Let's call this guy interactive dialogue. And now I have defined a generally reusable function that I could use to define all the examples that you've seen here. And how have I done that? Well, I've used the same trick that we use all the time. I look at some big expression and I look at some sub-expressions, E1, E2. And when I see that, I see this repetition, I see, well, really, these things are the only thing that vary. So what I've done is I say, well, what I do then is I'm defining a function, lambda x, lambda y, e of x and y. And then in order to get this expression back, I apply this lambda expression or this function to the original argument. And you can do this because of laziness and the lack of side effects. Because even though all these things here, like prelude here, to write down the type, it has type IO of unit. This just printed something to the console, this is a value of type IO of unit, but by itself it's pure. So I can just take it out of there and pass it as an argument. If I call f with something of this type, it won't be evaluated when I call that function. It will just create a value of type IO of unit completely lazily, and only in the end, when I run my program, everything will be executed. This is what I want to drive home, that in Haskell, these side effecting computations, IO computations, are just normal values like a list, integers, pair, that I can compose, I can put them in lists, I can abstract them as parameters from functions. So you can compose your giant computation and nothing will happen. Everything is pure, and only when I run it, in the end, things will happen. Now that's a very, very nice way, I think, to write programs, to glue together imperative computations. Simon Peyton-Jones says it a little bit differently. He says Haskell is the world's best imperative language. I refine that a little bit. I would say Haskell is the world's best scripting language because higher order functions like the one I defined here are very, very powerful glue, and you can encapsulate imperative computations inside the IO monad. All right, that was it for today, chapter 9. Try to do the exercise. You can download the slides. I hope that by now you all have a copy of the book. Also on the website, the book's website, there are solutions to the exercises. I'll keep tracking the forums, helping you guys out if you have any questions there. And thanks again for watching, and see you next time for chapter 10.